for another episode of Play-By-Playcast. It is the podcast about play-by-play broadcasters for play-by-play broadcasters and hosted by a play-by-play broadcaster, a professional development podcast that dives into the tips, tricks, experience, stories, process, and preparation of some of the biggest and best play-by-play announcers in the business. My name is Joel Godet. Our guest today is the voice of the Colorado Buffaloes, Mark Johnson. Mark, first off, thanks for taking the time.
You bet, Joel. Good to be out with you. And it's always fun to kind of talk about the business. We all talk in the business, but many times we'll get a chance to talk about the business. So this is kind of fun.
I want to dive into what may be the obvious question first and foremost. And I've seen a ton of interviews that you've done in the last year or so. So I don't just want to ask, like, what's it like to work with Coach Prime? But from a broadcast standpoint, what's it like to work with Coach Prime in terms of when you get somebody that is of that personality and nature and stature? Yeah. I imagine coaches' shows are very interesting. Coaches' interviews are probably very interesting. What was that side of things like for you in the last year?
Well, you got to remember, number one, you're dealing with an iconic personality, right? Whose entire world and life is in front of the camera or in front of a microphone. So a lot of coaches, as we well know in this business, are not big fans of doing the coaches shows and that kind of thing. In fact, my broadcast partner, Gary Barnett, who was here at Colorado when I got here coaching in 04 and 05, used to just detest having to do the coaches show. And when we brought him on as the analyst, they said, "You want to join us in the coaches show?" And he said, "Not a chance. I hated it when I was a coach. I don't want to do it now." And so you've got an individual that enjoys that kind of spotlight, number one. And so any interview with him, he's obviously phenomenal in front of the camera on the microphone. You don't have to delve very hard or press very hard to get him to talk about things. He loves it. He's a showman, I think, by nature. We know that when he was, you know, prime time or Neon Dion back in the day as a player. And so he loves that aspect of it. Now, the flip side of that is this. When you've got a guy that is, I'd say, one of one, he's as unique as anybody in the country. He comes in, he's an iconic figure, as I mentioned. He is a dynamic personality. He's a brand. He's a businessman. He's a corporation. He's all these different things. And so he's got 10,000 balls in the air at any given moment. And so when we do the show together, for example, he comes rolling in. His people, you know, bring him in the time we're supposed to meet. The cameras are on, the crowd's there, the lights are on, and we hit the air, and he's fantastic for the half hour that we do with him. And then when it's over very quickly, you know, we get a quick, "Mark, nice to see you" kind of thing, and his people sweeping away because he's always got 1,000 things on his schedule every single day. And so, you know, that's kind of the unique part about it. I think we're all accustomed to this business, at least I am, in my 35-plus years of doing this, and being able to sit down with a coach in his office, have some one-on-one time. It's very tough to do that because of, you know, the schedule and what it looks like every day for him. And so there are some aspects of it that are phenomenal. There are some that I wish we could have more time, but I understand what his schedule demands. And so it's always an interesting interview. And Joel, I'll tell you this. When Coach Prime does anything, I always say when he gets up and makes his eggs in the morning, it's front page news. The first time I got a text from a friend and say, "Hey, by the way, you're on the front page of the website for TMZ. I about fell off my chair thinking, "Oh my goodness, what have I done?" And then I realized, well, whatever Prime says ends up being national news. I just happen to be sitting next to him a lot of times when it happens.
How much has, and I use this word in a positive light, how much has the circus around it maybe changed what you do? Because, like, ultimately you're still calling a game, right? But I feel like, sure, to a certain degree, there's also a little bit of potential for, like, all right, well, let's do it this way, or let's try this, or let's try to hit a younger audience, or is there a way that you can approach things differently because of everything that comes along with it?
Well, I am what I am, all right? And, I live up on a ranch in the mountains of Colorado, and this time of year, now that the college seasons are over, I fly fish and I team rope and do those kind of things. So I am what I am. I can't all of a sudden, you know, act like Justin Bieber or something. That's probably going to not be a great reference, to be honest with you. I'm the most unhit man in America. So I can't do something I'm not to appeal to somebody just because Prime is here. And so I just try to do what I do And listen, Prime's bright enough to draw everybody. And the one thing I will tell you is the very first game we did, the game at TCU this year. So here the Frogs are coming off their national championship game appearance. They've got all kinds of hype for their season. Coach Prime with his first game for Colorado. And about midway through the first quarter, we hit a commercial break. And I look over at Gary Barnett and I said, you know, things are a little bit different. He said, what do you mean? And I said, man, my phone is exploding. Twitter's going out of its mind right now, because there are so many more people paying attention to what's happening with this program. That changes what I just talked about in terms of how you're around him and how things work when you're around him. That changes. But, you know, I don't need to do anything or try and be any different to draw people, because, you know, Prime takes care of that part of the equation pretty darn well. And so, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm not going to change in any way, shape, or form. I'm just going to do what I do, and I've got a much better story to talk about right now than I ever have in my career, for the most part.
Was this the most fun season you've had?
Well, it's the most interesting. You know, I always say I'm in the interesting business. We all are, right? We want interesting. We're all storytellers. We're there to narrate these great storylines that happen in sports as play-by-play announcers. And so, you know, the year before, I said many times, Colorado was the most uninteresting, least paid attention to program in America. And we went from irrelevancy to relevancy because one guy came on board. I was asked one time, I was at ESPN after I got hired, and they said, really, you don't think anybody else could bring this type of atmosphere? And I said, well, I don't know. You know, maybe if we hired Oprah Winfrey as the person following him, I don't know who else would bring this kind of, you know, hoopla to what we saw last year. So was it the best season? You know, over your shoulder, you got a Syracuse logo back there. I had a pretty good year in 2003, calling a national championship with Carmelo Anthony. And that was as fun a season as I've ever had. This, I'll say, was the most interesting season I've probably ever called.
I wanted to ask you about that too. And then we'll dive into the craft of this a little bit, but I obviously wanted to ask you about Prime, and you also worked with Jim Boeheim. Very different end of the spectrum. But I also feel like that's the kind of guy that you need to have your ducks in a row with when you interview. And if you give him the right questions, he'll give you the right answers.
Yes.
How much better did you get in that time at Syracuse interviewing him on a game-by-game basis?
Well, you got to remember, first off, when I got the Syracuse job in the fall of 2002, you know, I'm fresh off the turnip truck, man. I'm a North Dakota native. And I was at Illinois State prior to that. So I had a Division I job in the Missouri Valley Conference. And I get that job at Syracuse. And by the way, I'm not a Syracuse grad. And everyone in the broadcast industry understands what that means. And I get there and I walk on campus the first time. A guy named Carmelo Anthony does. And I'm like, well, okay, he's the number one recruit in America. I guess he's going to be pretty good. And this kind of squatty kid out of Scranton, Pennsylvania shows up. And it's Jerry McNamara. And I'm like, well, he doesn't look like much of a basketball player. Well, boy, was I wrong in all those accounts, because they were superstars. And eventually we called the national championship. And then, oh, by the way, I'm going to sit down and interview game in and game out one of the most accomplished Hall of Fame basketball coaches in the history of the game, who also is a little bit salty on occasion, right? I mean, he can be, we've seen the press conference, everyone has, he can be difficult in order to deal with. So, to your point, I made sure I had my ducks in a row. I was organized when I went in there. And then I learned while working with Jim, and I was a young guy, but 34, 35 years old, I guess, at the time, and learned how to navigate that. And because of that, he taught me a great deal about this business, how to approach things, how to ask questions, how to listen while I'm interviewing to make sure I pick up on subtleties, those kind of things. And Jim, depending upon the day, depending upon the circumstance, could give you a 2-minute answer to a question. He could give you a 3-second answer to a question. And so you've got to be on your toes in that regard, prepared. You know, I reminded him one time that, hey, we're doing an 8-minute pregame show. No matter if I ask 2 or 40 questions, we're going to do 8 minutes. And I had to be prepared, and I had to be able to navigate, how he was that day and how he responded. And I really enjoyed it. You know, just a short time ago, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, Colorado made the NCAA tournament. We were in Dayton, and I come around the corner, there was Coach standing there. He was doing the games for Westwood One. And so it was great to connect with him. First time we communicated, but first time we'd seen each other in a couple of decades, and that was wonderful. Believe me, I did give him a hard time for coming over to the dark side, by the way, and being part of the media now. And he returned the favor. But Jim taught me a lot, I think, as a young broadcaster.
I've always felt like that is one of the hardest jobs in the country. Like, I always thought this when I was in college. I was like, I'd never want to be a news reporter in that market, because the people that are watching are the professors at the school. And it's like, I would always think to myself, am I doing what they would be proud of as teachers? And like, that's not fair. But I don't know. Is it hard to be the voice of the Orange because of the microscope that's placed on it, because of the school and because of the people that have come out of that institution?
Well, I think there is something to that. And then add the layer to it about me coming in from the outside at that point in time. And I'll tell you a great story, and I'm not going to remember the columnist's name. You might remember. I worked for the local newspaper there in Syracuse.
Is it Bud?
I think that might be right. Yeah. Yes. We open up the season at BYU, okay, for football that year. And I'm just about to open up the play-by-play portion. We've gone through, Coach Mack and I had gone through, and Matt Park at that time was kind of our sideline guy, did some of our hosting, and obviously he replaced me after I left. And I'm sitting there, and I get a tap on the shoulder in the last commercial break before the opening kickoff. So we've done a couple of hours of pregame. And I turn around, and I look, and he's behind me, and I kind of, you know, tilt my earphone aside. I said, yeah. And he said, quick question for you. And I said, well, I'm just about to go on the air here. He goes, it won't take but a second. And I'm like, okay. And so as I pull my headphone back, I said, what's up? And he said, I'm just wondering, you're not being a Syracuse guy. If you do this game and everybody hates you, what are you going to do after the game? I mean, talk about not having a positive swing thought, right? If I could borrow a golf term right there. And I looked at him, I said, well, I'm not planning on that happening, but afterward, let's talk and we'll see what the reaction has been. And then I'm trying to get my head right because, you know, I'm the voice of the Orange, man. I'm doing my first game. There's been controversy that I got hired. There was all sorts of defense that had to be made by, you know, this kid from North Dakota being brought in to be the voice of the Orange. And I had to get ready and get myself, you know, prepared to do that ball game. So I did. It turned out relatively well. I got to call the national championship. I spent two wonderful years there and loved every single moment of it. And got some, you know, very nice response from the fans. But yeah, it's a unique position because of the history and the magnitude of the Newhouse School and what it has produced over, you know, the many decades.
How did you pitch that when you went after that job? Because I think a lot of people going after a lot of different jobs will see one and say like, oh, that's a place I would love to be the broadcaster for, but I'm not from there. I don't have ties to it. So like, what's my argument? How do I frame I'm the guy? That's one of the ultimate spots where it's like, listen, I know you could pick any one of your people, so to speak, but I'm the guy. How do you frame that when you go into it, and how'd it work?
Well, Joel, it's interesting because I had interviewed for another job in the Big East just prior to that. And in fact, I was about ready to leave for that interview. And I got a note from a friend of mine that said, hey, the Syracuse job is open. I kind of chuckled. Like, well, dude, I'm not part of them. I'm not getting that gig. And so my wife was actually up with her parents, and we were going to meet in this city in which I was going to go interview. And we talked on the phone that night, and I told her, hey, you know, the Syracuse job. She goes, well, send something. I said, babe, I'm not one of those guys. Okay. I'm a North Dakota grad. I'm not a Syracuse grad. And she says, oh, come on. You know, what is it? You know, $5-$10 at that time, you're sending a resume and a CV, right? And so I thought, okay, fine, whatever. So that night I quickly gathered some stuff, threw in a box, sent it off, and thought, I'll never hear a word about it. Go down, interview for the other job. I actually was offered the job. And then I looked at my wife and I said, I don't feel comfortable with this. I'm turning down a much greater situation than I was in. But I thought, I got wife and children at the time, and I'm not sure I feel comfortable raising my family in the city in which it was. And so I'm flying back thinking, man, I'm killing my career right now. I got a great opportunity there and I'm going to say no to it. So I did, but I got home and I had voicemails. Now, this is pre-cell phone for everybody out there, right? That's why nobody called my cell phone. I got back in my office line, was filled up with messages about Syracuse. And they wanted to talk to me. And so they flew me out for an interview. And so I went on out. And, you know, I realized I wasn't going to compete with the bloodline, if you will, of being in the Syracuse family. And so I just basically pitched myself. This is what I am. This is how I call a game. This is what I do in the community. This is how I represent myself. All those kind of things. And it obviously worked out very well. And whatever I was selling, they bought it that time anyway.
Let's dive into how you call a game. I think first and foremost, the thing that obviously comes across when you hear your voice is your voice. And I know to some degree, that's your voice. Like that's how the good Lord blessed you. But I also saw an interview where you said you overcame a stutter growing up.
I did.
How did you go from there to being someone who makes their living communicating?
Well, I've always been a very determined guy. I was an athlete, not a very good athlete, but I was an athlete, played college basketball at the Division II level. And so I've always been a very determined individual. I come from that kind of background. You think of the upper Midwest where I'm from and kind of that hard-nosed, nose to the grindstone, work ethic kind of people. And there was something very early that kind of piqued my interest about speaking, and I wasn't very good at it. I come from a very stoic background. I used to joke with my family all the time, okay, seriously, really, who's my parents? Because this can't be it, because nobody speaks. They would rather do anything on earth but speak in front of people. But I always felt compelled in that direction. In fact, I really thought, Joel, coming out of high school, I was going to be either a pastor or a sportscaster. Talk about an odd combination there. I end up going into sportscasting. I do pastoring now. I actually do a lot of preaching at this point. But I thought to myself, okay, I stutter a little bit. How can I get over this? How do I work through this? And then I'll be real honest with you. In the state of North Dakota, you know, you're kind of the state that nobody thinks about. Let's be real honest about it. If anybody talks about the Dakotas, they always mention South Dakota. I get that all the time. I get introduced to you. He's from South Dakota. No, I'm not. I'm from North Dakota. And Tom Brokaw was from South Dakota. And Tom was the NBC Nightly News anchor. I had a chance after the championship, by the way, to communicate with Tom. He sent me a gift and congratulated me for being the voice of the champions at that point in time. But Tom was a bit of a motivation and inspiration for me, because I thought, well, he's not from North Dakota, but he's from South Dakota. And if he can do it from there and become successful in this industry, maybe I can as well. And then I kept thinking, okay, he doesn't sound anything like the people I grew up around. Have you ever seen the movie Fargo? You know what I'm talking about. And so I worked at that. I purposely went about the idea of thinking, I can't have that kind of accent that they have up there. And the stuttering was just me working on it and putting reps in, if I could borrow an athletic term, right? Being an athlete, I thought in that terms, the reps, how do I do it? How do I control my anxiety about that? How do I go about overcoming this? And so it was just something that I put a great deal of effort into. And, you know, Bill Walton, who we all know, of course, and I've gotten to know quite well here in the Pac-12, he had a stuttering issue when he was younger, and he learned to overcome that as well. But there's a number of people in the business who have had that. And so it's just something that I worked on, continued to, really think about and look at different exercises I could do. How can I, overcome that disconnection, if you will, between what happens up here and what comes out of my mouth, those kind of things. And, you know, it took a little while, but the more I got comfortable with it, the more confidence I gained. More confidence you gain, the better you perform. And that's kind of the way the process worked.
Who'd you look up to from a broadcast sense growing up?
Well, the Tom Brokaw thing, obviously. But from a sports standpoint, I think there were probably three people. And if you knew all three and you listened to me, you'd hear all three. And that's probably true for anybody in this business, right? We all emulate to some degree. We borrow, and then we create our own voice within the business. So there was a guy named Jim Bowman in my hometown of Grand Forks, North Dakota, who did the University of North Dakota, that I eventually, when I got a little bit older, broadcast at that time the Fighting Sioux, now the Fighting Hawks. But I did that. But Jim was a guy that I listened to, just a local guy. Ray Christensen was a longtime voice of the Minnesota Golden Gophers. Ray was there. And so that was the closest Division I school to where I grew up. And so I listened to WCCO out of Minneapolis, and I'd listened to Ray and how he called a game. And I always enjoyed, his professionalism, the detail that he had. I thought Ray was outstanding. And then, later on in my teen years, when the Minnesota Timberwolves came around, Kevin Harlan did the Timberwolves early on. And so there was much about Kevin. And if you listen to he and I, we've got similarities in terms of how we call. But all three of those guys really influenced me in one way or another, from a preparation standpoint, from a detail standpoint, from a professionalism standpoint, stylistically. They're all in there if you listen to it. I always told young broadcasters, I taught both at Syracuse and here at the University of Colorado, you have to find your voice. But until you find your voice, you borrow from others, And then that's your building blocks, okay? Just like, you know, Kobe Bryant talked about watching Michael Jordan, and you could see similarities in their game, but he became his own player. We do that in broadcasting as well. You find your own voice. You find your own personality. You find your own demeanor, you know, on the camera, behind the microphone. And all three of those guys, I think, played a great role in building, you know, what eventually I became.
How would you describe that? How would you describe that voice, that personality, what it sounds like to listen to a Mark Johnson game?
Well, I know what I hope it sounds like. I hope it sounds like professionalism. I hope it sounds like I know exactly what's happening in the game. I've always said one of my litmus tests has been this. I hope that there's a truck driver flying down I-70 or I-25, right? He's going through the Rocky Mountain region. And on a Saturday afternoon, he dials up a Colorado football game on KOA radio or on Sirius XM, whatever it is. And he thinks to himself after a while, number one, I know exactly what's going on in this game. Number two, I'm pretty sure this guy is the bus announcer because I can hear it in his voice. And number three, I had a good time doing it. Those are the three things I want. I want the accuracy. I want to tell the story because the game is the story. I want people to enjoy it and maybe have a chuckle or two and understand that we're having a good time, but that they got an honest presentation of the game. I always like to say, not every call that goes against Colorado is a bad call. Not every call that goes against the opposition is a good call. And I'm going to be honest about that. And fans over the years have taken me to task on that. Because like, MJ, why do you have to say that? That was obviously, no, it wasn't obviously. In fact, I think it was quite the contrary. So I try to be very, very honest, but do so with a love for my team because that's the team that I call.
Yeah, living in New England as we record this, you run into that a lot with whether or not that was a moving screen in the Final Four the other day. So it's like, no, not always. doesn't always go the right way. I want to talk about partners with you on the air. And you work with Gary Barnett now, but before you worked with him in football, you worked with your predecessor.
Yes.
And I'm curious what that relationship was like for you from a couple of different angles. Number one, making it easier because you're working with a guy that's had that job and been in that role and that everybody knows and they can ease you into it, but also how you approach quite literally working with the guy that used to do that job. Because everybody always says it's hard to fill somebody's shoes. I have to imagine it adds a different layer when those shoes are right next to you.
Joe, you know that old line, you don't want to be the guy after the guy. You want to be the guy after the guy after the guy, right? Believe me, when word started getting out that KOA Radio and CU were talking to me about this job, I had a number of friends of mine in the business drop me a line and said, dude, do not take that job. Larry Zimmer was legendary voice of the bus. Zim was there forever since 1971. I got here in 2004. And people said, don't touch it. You don't want to do that. You don't want to replace him. You know, you didn't want to replace Chick Hearns. You don't play Jack Buck. I mean, all just name the guy, Ernie Harwell. You don't want to replace those guys because they're impossible shoes to fill. Well, I'm not the smartest guy in the world. And there was something about this opportunity growing up where I did. You always looked at either Denver or Minneapolis. Denver was a place I enjoyed. I'm an outdoorsman, as I talked about. I thought, I want to be there. KOA was a legendary, obviously, you know, clear channel radio station, 50,000 watts, one of the monsters in the country, huge sports department. And so stupidly or smartly, I'm not sure which, I decided I'm going to take this job. I'll tell you how things worked out. That was kind of interesting. I was doing Syracuse. Well, I always get confused. We got Sky Chiefs here, Sky Sox there, right? Did I get that wrong? I'm not sure if I get that wrong.
Sky Chiefs there, Sky Sox here. Yep.
There we go. That's right. Yeah, I always get those mixed up. I was doing some baseball one day. We happened to be in a rain delay, and my phone rings. It was after I accepted the job, and it's a 303 number, and I pick it up, and it was Jim on the phone. And so we knew each other by reputation. We had never talked. I'd never met Larry, him being out here and me being in the East Coast. And as we talked, I finally said, well, Zim, when did you find out that they were going to bring me on board? And he said, yesterday. And I said, well, obviously you knew. And he said, no, I didn't find out I was being moved over to the number two chair until yesterday. Well, I was mortified at that. And I said, Larry, I am terribly sorry. I had no idea. I thought you were fully involved in the search and la, 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 la. And I said, I feel awful about this. And to Larry's credit, and this is why we became so close, he said to me, Mark, this will never be an issue between you and I. We both know that what we're supposed to do is broadcast the game. That's number one. And so you had nothing to do with this. I don't have any or harbor any feelings against you. And that set the tone for our relationship. Now, fast forward to August, I get here to Colorado. And the first event we have, there was always the Rocky Mountain Showdown, Colorado State, to start the season back then. And there was always a very large pep rally and an event in downtown Denver. And I'm sitting out in the crowd. There's, I don't know, 12, 14, 1500 people maybe at this event. And they introduce me as, ladies and gentlemen, the voice of the Buffaloes, Mark Johnson. And as I'm walking up to the stage, Joel, something didn't sit right with me about that. And so when I got on stage, I looked out at the crowd and I said, thank you for the wonderful welcome. It's great to be here. I'm happy to join this, you know, the great history of Colorado football. But I said, would you guys do me a favor in telling, Jim was sitting right down front, I said, until that man retires, he's the voice of the Buffaloes and I'm the play-by-play announcer. And that's the way I treated Jim from the beginning through the 12 years we worked together. Every broadcast, you can go back and listen, I'd open up and say, alongside legendary voice of the Buffs, Larry Zimmer, I'm Mark Johnson, and then we just kind of move on. Zim was a great mentor to me, taught me a great deal, taught me some great history, by the way. You know the way that is. When a guy comes into town, for you young broadcasters out there, you better learn the ins and outs, who's who, how to say the names of the towns that you might be referencing, because nothing says out of towner and you're not one of us like mispronouncing some name that's prominent within that organization or that program. And so Zim helped me with all of those. If I make a mistake, he very gently kind of correct me and help me understand what the context was. And so it was great sitting beside him for 12 years. And you probably well know this. We just buried Sam here just a few weeks ago and a great loss in the Buff Nation community. But he was wonderful to me over the course of 12 years.
What did he teach you from a broadcasting standpoint?
Well, he had great passion. First off, with the history, great passion for the business. I mean, he grew up, you know, he was an LSU guy, eventually graduated from Missouri, broadcast Michigan early on, then was the Buffs and Broncos announcer for many years here in the Denver area. So he taught me that. He taught me, I think, a lot about the preparation beyond what I already knew. He taught me about the love for fans. One of his favorite things was socializing. Friday night before a Saturday football game on the road was right down, you know, that was his wheelhouse right there, man. He loved it. That was always a great night. And he taught me a lot about kind of that atmosphere within the booth and making it kind of family atmosphere. A lot of broadcasters, if you look back, you see a lot of change within their booth over the years. I've had no change in 20 years here at the University of Colorado. Same engineer all those years. Only had two producers. I've really only had two color analysts. Sideline people, we've kind of rotate different people in and out, so that's been altered. But because of what I learned from him, I think there's been great continuity within our broadcast, and there's some great lessons I think that Sim taught me.
That's awesome. What for you constitutes a good broadcast? Like when you can step aside from the table at the end of the day, we did X, Y, and Z right, so we did our job well.
Yeah. I think number one has to be, did we tell the proper story? And one thing I always, between, a lot of times Gary will take off after a ball game, but Jim used to hang around, being that he was, you know, comes from a journalistic background. That's another thing Jim always talked about. We're journalists up here. We're not just announcers. We're journalists. So Jim was very big on that. But I always meet with my producer, my engineer, and a lot of times the sideline guy will hang around afterward. And I walk in after we get through the post game. Let me do tape a lot of TV stuff after a game. And I sit down and say, okay, fellas, what did we miss? What did we get right? What did we miss? We always ask that question. So it was about a 15-minute conversation. And we look at the storylines. Did we miss anything from this game that afterward we found out was a storyline? Did we miss a circumstance? So the accuracy is number one. The game's always number one. The accuracy always, in terms of the evaluation, has to be number one. Did we tell the proper story? And then, okay, if we miss something, how do we miss it? And how do we correct that then by the next ball game? So those are always the things that I look at. You know, if we had a couple of good laughs during it, that's outstanding. That's an added bonus. If, you know, we ended up with an interesting interview on the sideline or something, that's an added bonus. But it's always about the game. Make no mistake about that. And I hear sometimes, you know, young broadcasters will want to make their mark in the business. And if I listen to them, you know, I'll dial around on SiriusXM every once in a while just to kind of see what's going on out there and listen to different ball games. And you can tell when a guy's trying to make a mark and make himself known. Be careful about that. Tell the proper story. Be accurate. Be true to the game. And I think the rest kind of falls into place by the time it's all said and done. So for me, it's as simple as that. Did we tell the proper story today? And if we missed something, I give the eyebrow raise to my producer and go, okay, let's make sure we don't miss that next week.
I'm glad you brought that up or framed it that way, because I've had conversations in the booth before where the game's ended and I'm sitting there, my analyst has looked at me and he's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, I don't know if we painted the right story arc. And he's like, what do you mean? Sure. It's like, when I look back at it, it's like, all right, what was the story? What are the through lines and how did we carry those through? And through the years, I've actually tried to do a couple of things to try to keep myself honest in that area. Where like, I will write down bullet points. I'm like, these are three things I think are important. I want to touch on. I want to go back to. You'll alter those at halftime. At least I'll try and see like, all right, how is this story changing? Are there things that you do going into a game to say like, hey, this is what's important to me, or this is what my analyst is thinking about. I want to make sure I go back to them on this. Like, how do you make sure that you're painting that appropriate picture as the game goes on?
Well, I think we've all got the preconceived notion of what the story is going into the game, right? And so I've got my bullet points that I think are going to be. Gary and I meet before the game. He and I, when we walk in, there's always a meeting before. We do, like a lot of schools, we do our first hour out amongst the fans. And so we get there plenty early. It drives Gary crazy. We get there way too early for his days. He always says, okay, great. We got the T-shirt again. We're the first ones here. So I like to get there early, right? And we talk about those kind of things. And from Gary's standpoint, for example, he brings the football. He brings that coach's knowledge. He comes in and says, here are the statistical or X's and O's storylines we need to be thinking about today. Fantastic. Okay, we've got that. I bring in, and my producer brings in, the different kind of, newsish story items, if you will, that need to be addressed during the game. Is there somebody making a run at a record? Is there some significance to this game today in terms of its history or whatever it might be? All the different things we look for. And so we accumulate all of that before a ball game. And then that's front of mind as we go into the ball game. But you can never be married to that. That's nothing more than just kind of a handshake agreement right there. Because as the game goes on, the storyline changes. I once had a young person in the social media world say to me one time, we can't do that because we need to know what you're going to do post-game before the game. And I said, I can't tell you that. The game's going to tell us the story. That's going to be what determines what we tell ultimately when the game's said and done. And so with that in mind, we sit down and we go in with those concepts and those storylines. We address them as they become pertinent and appropriate within the game. And then as the game is unfolding, things are changing. And all of a sudden, if I've got five things, we take out number two and number four because now they're not pertinent anymore. And we add in, these other six and seven because there's something we didn't anticipate that has happened during the ball game. And so it's the nimbleness of the broadcast that has to change. And, another one of the kind of the measuring sticks I like to use, and we see this especially in basketball. Tad Boyle, who's a basketball coach here at Colorado, is so good about this. My partner, Scott Wilkie, is a former player here for Colorado. A lot of times after the game, we do the coaches interview and we look at each other and go, well, we talked about 1, 2, and 3, and Tad mentioned 1, 2, and 3 after the game. Maybe we did a pretty good job evaluating. And so, those are just the ways we approach it, how we change, how we're nimble during the game, and we're adaptable during the contest, because those storylines are always going to be different post-game than they were pre-game.
Football and basketball obviously are the biggest things that you do, but I know, and you've talked about it a couple of times, you are an avid outdoorsman, big Western guy. I know, president of a rodeo association. Have you ever broadcast rodeo, fly fishing, hunting, anything that is ideally Colorado in nature?
Well, I've never broadcast, but I've announced, like in the stadium. Done rodeo announcing in the stadium. Yeah, I've done that kind of thing. And, there's a big difference between doing a broadcast, whether it be radio or television, and doing PA. Those are two very different things. Now, with that being said, if you're doing PA for a football game, or you're doing, I've done PA, I both broadcast and done PA for the Colorado Rockies at different times. One, you're telling a full story. The other one, you're being very bullet pointish, right? Okay, here's who's batting you know, that kind of thing when you're doing PA. The rodeo announcer kind of melds the two of them a little bit. It's not a broadcast in terms of it going out over a medium, over radio or television, but you are doing a hybrid within the stadium. And so everything applies that applies to doing a radio broadcast or a television, you know, broadcast as well. You have to be prepared. You have to know what you're talking about. You have to know the rules. You have to know the personalities. In that job, when you're doing a rodeo like that, you've got to be a little bit of a entertainer because you're working with the rodeo clown. If you've ever been to one, to know what that is. And so it's really kind of a fun deal. I get a kick out of it. I don't do a lot of it, but I do a few, it seems like every year in one form or another. And it's just one more way to exercise being a broadcaster. Joel, I've always said, I used to ask my students this all the time. We'd get into class the first day and I do two things. And for young broadcasters, you might want to hear both of these. I'd walk in and I would lay down a transcript of Vin Scully doing the perfect game. Sandy Koufax doing Sandy Koufax's the bottom of the ninth inning, Sandy Koufax's perfect game. And then I would play the video and I wouldn't say anything other than read this and read along with the video. And we'd get done with that video of him doing it. It's the great Scully half inning where he's talking about, he mentions the time in the City of Angels and he's just perfectly, you know, constructing this half inning of baseball. And we get done with that and I'd always say, okay, that's what we're here to learn how to do. You will never do it that well. In fact, if I challenge you to sit down and write that, you would never be able to create it as well as Vin Scully did, because he's the best there ever was, the best there ever will be. And anybody who says otherwise, I'll call you a damn liar, okay? So that's number one I would do with all of my students. The second thing, and then I'd go around the class and say, okay, you want to be a broadcaster, a sportscaster, why? And I'd ask them. And they'd all give me different answers. I love sports. Not wrong answer. And they'd give me 100 different answers. And I'd get down to the very end of it and I'd say, you've given me wrong answers, every single one of you. The reason you want to be a sportscaster is because you love broadcasting. Broadcasting is the basis for all of this. We just happen to enjoy sports and get a chance to broadcast sports. I've always said, if they told me tomorrow you'd never broadcast another game, I would still be a broadcaster, right? And then I talk about, Al Michaels in the Earthquake World Series and how he won a news Emmy because he was a great broadcaster. He handled that masterfully. People like Bob Costas, who are wonderful broadcasters. Anybody who is great in this business, you could take them out of sports and put them somewhere else within the industry, and they would still be outstanding because they're great broadcasters. And that's the number one thing everybody has to remember when you're trying to be, you know, a play-by-play announcer. Are you a good broadcaster? Because if all you are is a play-by-play announcer, there are going to be holes in your game, and it's going to show at some point or another.
Jumping off of that, I'm glad you said that, because I think people often have asked me, like, what do you love about this, or what do you do? Like, why is this great to you? And it's like, I love being on the air. Like, I love the act of broadcasting. I love the craft of it. I think that it's interesting. Like, I like sports, but I like broadcasting of the sports. And I've never really quite been able to define it. And I'm glad that you did. What is it that you love about broadcasting?
Well, I think there's two things you have to have. There's three. There's three things you have to have to do what we do. Number one, you have to love being a storyteller. And I am in my life. Number two, you have to be a natural observer, because you have to pay attention to facts. And that bothers my wife sometimes, because I'm trying to pay attention to all kinds of things. Like, well, how did you even notice that? Well, that's what I do. I kind of watch. If I'm out in a public setting, I'm not necessarily the guy that's talking all the time. Simply not doing that. I'm watching. I'm listening, right? The number one attribute you have to have as a great interviewer is to be a great listener. People always miss that, right? People are always thinking about the next question instead of listening to what's being said so you can react to that and utilize what's been offered to you. And the number three thing I think you have to, to do play-by-play, you have to be able to process very, very quickly. It has to develop here and come out very, very quickly. So if you're one of those slow-to-talk kind of people, that's a very tough thing to be, because by the time you figure it out, you spit out the words, you're four or five plays behind what actually happened. So for me, it's just the love of storytelling and the challenge then of how well can I describe what I'm seeing when you're doing radio. Wait, listen, I've done television play-by-play as well, and you know, you can make more money in TV, obviously, But radio, for any real broadcaster, you love doing radio because you're it. You're everything. You're the eyes, ear, and senses for the person that's out there listening. They don't understand anything until you say it. I got one of those great letters here not long ago. Some guy who had no clue about Colorado, lived out east, sent me a letter this past season, an email actually, and just said, I stumbled upon your broadcast. I was flipping through, and it was such a joy because I felt that, and this gentleman was visually impaired, and said, I felt like I could see it, and I was sitting on the edge of my seat. And so those are the kind of things we live for in this business. When you can do that, and it's just, does it feed an ego? Sure, it feeds your ego, right? This is a performance deal. And so just like anything else, like when you're an athlete and the crowd cheers, we get the same kind of thing in this business because we're performers in some respect. And so it does feed that aspect of it. But really for me, it's the observation and the storytelling that I just get a kick out of.
Is the performance aspect of it hard? And I only say that from the standpoint of, especially younger broadcasters, I feel like, get into it and think, and I was this way 100% when I started. It's like, I'm going to go broadcast the game, and I'm going to call the game, and I'm going to tell you what's happening, and I'll describe the action, and that's that. But like, it is a performance. People are wanting to be entertained, and that's not just in the information they're getting, it's how they're getting it. How did you learn to make it a performance and not necessarily just be Mark Johnson, but be Mark Johnson, the broadcaster, when the red light went on?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. When I say performance, I don't necessarily mean that we're entertaining. However, there is some of that. Now, depending on what we're doing, I was a talk show host a few times in my career. You've got to be more entertaining there than you do when you're doing play-by-play, right? Because the game is carrying the broadcast. Well, what I mean by performance, Joel, is this. When I walk in and crack the microphone, and I learned this very early in my career, the first thing I did, I always call it my long-haired, maggot-infested disc jockey days, all right? I was an FM guy. Magic Mark. Yeah, you can call me Magic Mark back in the day. By the way, no relation nor similarity to Magic Mike, right? Not the same thing in any way, shape, or form. But I was Magic Mark back in the day. And I worked on an FM station, number of FM stations. In fact, I was in North Dakota, then out in California. I worked with Jim Rome. Jim was on the AM side at that point in time. Got to know him back in the day. But the performative aspect that I'm talking about is this. When I walked in the studio, and I had a program director at the time that always told me to put a smile on your voice, right? And at the time, what he did, he taught me, and I'm 20 years old. My college basketball career come to an end with an injury, a back surgery. And I get into the radio, and he had me put a picture of a family member in front of me. He says, talk to that person. Perform for that person. Put a smile on your voice. Let the person that's driving in the car, they're getting off work, their day sucked, they're angry about life, and they hear your voice, and there's something about it that brings a smile to them. They're hearing the smile on your voice. And then the second half of that, he said, I don't care what happened. I don't care if you're fighting with your wife, if your kids are awful and the bills are piling up and the dishwasher just broke and the car broke down. When you walk in, nobody cares about that. They want to hear something that brightens their day. And so that's the performative aspect that I think is really important, that when I hit the air, regardless of what's happening in my life, I'm going to come on the air and be the same guy on Thursday night when the Buffs are taking on, Oregon State, or Saturday when they're taking on Oregon, whatever it is, they're going to get the same effort from me and the same sound and the same feel, and there's going to be an energy about it. And, so that's the performative aspect I think a lot of people don't think about. What's going on in your personal life really doesn't matter to the person that's sitting out there on the other end of the speaker or the television. And that's where we have to perform to some degree.
Mark, if people want to find more Mark Johnson in their lives or catch the Colorado Buffaloes, where do they do that?
Well, you can go to Twitter or X, right, at MJ Buffs Voice, and you're going to get, eventually I do a lot of ministry stuff. You're going to get a lot of that. You're going to get a lot of Buffs. You're going to get a little fly fishing and some team roping, and I'll bore you stiff with my two granddaughters. So if you want to find out that kind of stuff, go to at MJ Buffs Voice on X or Twitter, and you can find me there.
We got to get you to do play-by-play for fly fishing at some point. Like, I just feel like it's just too good.
Well, you know what? All those years, you know, I always say about baseball, you know, people ask me what's the difference between the sports. I say, well, baseball's, you know, well, it used to be. Now they shorten the game a little bit, but it used to be 3.5 hours of broadcast and 8 minutes of action. Okay. When I did Rockies baseball, that's the way I always thought about it. Now, in terms of fly fishing, it might be 4 hours of action and about 42 seconds or a broadcast rather than 42 seconds of action, right? Because there's a lot of downtime in between and not a lot of strategy in terms of movement. You might talk about changing the flies and the depth of your rod and all that kind of stuff, but there wouldn't be a lot to talk about in between. It'd be very golf-like, a lot of whispering, I think, would have to be done during that broadcast.
That's fair. That is true. I say that like I know what's happening. I've been in a boat once in my life. Mark, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Joel, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.